So Mark chapter 7, starting in verse 1. It says, "Now when the Pharisees gathered to him with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, they saw that some of his disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands properly, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches. And the Pharisees and the scribes asked him, 'Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with defiled hands?'" So this group of people, the Pharisees, we've seen these people before. Up till now, in chapter 7 of this gospel, we've seen they're the religious leaders of the day. And we've seen that they're having an awful lot of conflict with Jesus. They're questioning why he's doing the things he's doing. They're questioning how he's doing the things he's doing. For example, on the Sabbath day, that's Saturday, that's the day of worship in the Jewish weekly calendar, Jesus is healing people. He's doing things that they see as work. Okay, and so they found fault in how he was living out his Sabbath. And Jesus didn't sit by and let them criticize him. He actually confronted them about their false understanding of the Sabbath. But we've seen these conflicts, okay? And we see another one here. These people approach Jesus and they ask him why he's doing it the way he's doing. Now, this is a Jewish sect of people, a Jewish denomination, if you will. They're known for their strict religious observance. They're known for their rule following. Impressively so. They're known for creating extra rules above and beyond what God would have and doing an awful good job at following them. Okay, and so these hand washings, unsurprisingly, they're not God's law. They're not God's way. That's why Jesus wasn't doing them. It's the way of the Pharisees, and we'll talk about this as we go. The topic for tonight, the main premise we're going to work off of is the idea of being defiled. Okay, you saw it in the question that they asked. They approach Jesus. They try to tell him that he and his disciples are defiling themselves by not following the religious rules. They're making themselves unclean. They're dirtying themselves by not doing the right things. Okay, this is the heart of our chapter tonight. There's the questions. What constitutes being defiled? Okay, what makes us dirty or otherwise unworthy before God? And the flip side of that is, what makes us clean? Okay, how, when, and where are we considered unclean? These are the questions we're going to try to answer tonight as we go. Now, the idea of being defiled, this is completely unpopular in the day in which we live. Okay, this is very foreign to our culture. Maybe if you grew up in church, you understand this. Maybe if you grew up with any sort of moral upbringing, it'll be familiar, the feelings of being defiled or feeling guilt and shame and all the rest. But very, very little is considered dirty in our time. The practices of our modern day 21st century people, they don't really care whether something is shameful or immoral. The lines of morality have been sort of washed away, haven't they? I'm not saying we're in these ultra extremes. We still live in the Midwest. Okay, we're still here in Wisconsin, about 20 years behind any coast. But these things are crumbling. Okay, people feel guilt and shame in their quieter moments, at best. Lying awake at night, worrying about what life should be, how it should go. But the expectation placed upon anybody that you should feel guilt if you did something immoral, that's being removed from the equation. In fact, you're told to embrace what you do. Own up to it. Don't feel bad about it. Go for it. Okay? Unlock the mystery of who you're meant to be by doing whatever you want, whatever you feel. And so it's becoming more and more foreign for you to be prescribed, for you to be told that you should pay attention to the guilt and the shame that you feel. Now, biblically speaking, guilt and shame are a good thing. These are indicators for us. Okay, when you're cooking in the kitchen and you see smoke with your eyes, that gray haze, that's an indicator that something's burning. Or the smell, you know, of burnt. What did we cook the other night? I burnt oatmeal the other day. I know that. Okay, the smell of burnt oatmeal, that was an indicator something's wrong. And also don't eat it because it's gross. But these are indicators. Guilt and shame are indicators in the same way. Something's off. You're out of step with God. That guilt you're feeling, it might be your own personal conscience trying to feel guilty, and plenty of us do that, but it's probably more realistically, no, I think I might be out of tune with God, out of step, out of harmony with God. Guilt and shame are not a bad thing. This idea of being defiled, making yourself unclean, yes, it's wrong, but the reaction to it is to own up, to face up to God, to return yourself to Him, and to make things right. And any sort of this idea of defilement being, you know, here's where we are in modern day. Christians are behind in the times. This is what people think. They're behind in the times. They're oppressive. Isn't this bad to your self-esteem to be told that you should feel guilt when you make a mistake or when you make a moral choice that's bad? People think this about Christians. This is antiquated. This is out of date. It's not practical for today. And I'm telling you, it still is. And I'm telling you that when it comes to this topic of defilement, we all kind of know what it's like, and yet many of us ignore it. And we all kind of know what it feels like, and many of us will assume, because we're told that it's wrong to feel that way, that, okay, I'm just going to push that off. I'm going to shrug it off. I'm not going to actually pay attention to it. I'm telling you, we need to pay attention to it. Jesus is going to answer the question about what defiles a person. We'll get to it in a few verses. Pharisees here, they thought it was their external behavior. They thought if you follow the rules, you've done right and you're clean. You stay clean by following the rules. But if you break the rules, you've done wrong, now you're dirty, you need to do something to make up for it. And then, hence the hand washings here. They said Jesus and his disciples didn't practice the thing that all Jews were doing, these hand washings. The big idea here, Pharisees would wash their hands before a meal, not for cleanliness, not for germs, you know, not to avoid COVID. Like, they didn't wash their hands for the sake of hygiene. It was ceremonial. It was representative. It was to purify themselves, their whole selves. And here's how it went. They went to the market. You know, they went to the Menominee's Farmer's Market. They picked up a Bami sandwich. And who knows who they bumped into while they were waiting in the very, very long Bami sandwich line, okay? Or who knows who handled the paper that the sandwich was wrapped in. It may have been somebody who was unclean themselves, and that uncleanliness transferred to me, and so therefore I needed a ceremonial hand wash so that, okay, I can be clean again. It was a mixture of paranoia and, you know, this obsessive desire to look holy, to present themselves outward as holy. Another version, maybe there was a bug, you know, the bug landed on somebody that was unclean, and then it flew and it landed on me, okay, transferring that person's it was this very, very extreme, again, a mix of paranoia, but this extreme desire to keep themselves clean because of these micro and minor nuances that probably weren't happening, and yet they put all their effort into doing this. Okay, Jesus rebukes them at another place. They say, you strain your cup so that you don't accidentally swallow a gnat, which means you would have eaten the blood of an insect, I guess. You strain all of your drinks, but you ignore forgiveness, mercy, kindness, love. You ignore the weightier measures of the law, and you focus too much on the minority things. That's what they're doing here with these hand washings, okay? So they're trying to cleanse themselves. That's the idea, and we're going to get rolling forward here. And then they try and tell their people they should do the same. Now, God's law in the Old Testament, those of you that have read through the Old Testament, especially those of you that have been in Leviticus recently, this is your day to shine, okay? You, in your mind, you're rolling out all the possibilities of, okay, I think I remember something about this. There was nothing that said you needed to wash your hands before a meal to cleanse yourself. Priests had commands to wash themselves before they offered sacrifices. There is some hand-washing prescription-type stuff in the Leviticus is chapter 15, if you want to go look at it. I'm not going to explain it tonight, not here and now, but they took those concepts and said, we're going to apply them to other aspects of life. They're looking to earn extra credit. They're looking to take what God said was good and say, yeah, but we can do better, okay? We can do more. So they took what God said was good and they tried to do more than he even asked, more than he required, thinking that that would give them extra credit with God. Okay, that's what they're doing. God's way is good, our way is even better. Well, let's look at how Jesus responds to them. Look at verse 6. He said to them, well, did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites? As it is written, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. And then verse 8, you leave the commandment of God and you hold to the tradition of men. This is what he tells them. You leave the commandment of God and you hold to the tradition of men. So first he calls them hypocrites. Okay, he says their outward expressions of worship are fake. It's a lie. They're not really feeling that in their heart. They don't love God. They don't trust God. This is all external so that people will respect them. They'll look as though they're religious and holy. They don't trust God. They trust themselves. They trust in these external religious acts to keep them clean. God's not cleaning them. They're cleaning themselves, spiritually speaking. And this is a different definition of a hypocrite than I think we're probably used to. Most often we think hypocrite is somebody that says one thing and then does something totally different. Most politicians in our day and age, hypocrites, right? Okay, you say one thing, you make promises in one direction, and you don't follow through, or you just do the exact opposite because it's not convenient for you to do the thing you said you were going to do. Most of us would say that's a hypocrite, right? The very, very obvious thing. And we all end up being hypocrites ourselves, don't we? We all do this. I mean, our personal failings, our moments of weakness, our, you know, Tuesdays and Thursdays and Fridays, we all end up doing this. Jesus' definition of hypocrite is a little bit different than that. He says a hypocrite is someone who pretends to be something they're not. This word for hypocrite actually means play actor, an actor in a play, somebody who pretends to be something that they're not. So these people, these guys, they pretend to honor God by showing off in front of other people, but internally they don't care about God at all. Verse 6, they honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. And then verse 7, in vain they worship me. They're attempting to be religious, but Jesus says it's all vanity. It's not accomplishing anything for them. Okay? They're worshiping God in the wrong way. They're worshiping God with the wrong hearts. And this is a surefire way to get no credit from God. You won't get any favor. You won't get any blessing. Worshiping God is relational. You do it because you love him. You do it because he loves you. And I got the order of that wrong. You do that because he loves you, and you do it because you love him. They're doing it for an outward show. And we can all do that too, can't we? Show up for church, pretend like we're into it. And maybe we're not. We can't hyper-analyze every motive we have, but you can put forth a little bit of effort internally to say, no, I'm here for God. I'm going to put off all those expectations that previously I was just thinking, like, I'll at least make sure they think I'm a good Christian, and I'll show up again, you know? You can fight that off. You can fight your own motives internally and say, no, I'm going to make my heart right before I show up, okay? Or as you're standing there during worship, or as you're sitting there right now, okay? You can do that. You can still address your own heart. We all end up doing this in some measure. And it's a battle. It's an internal battle to right our wrong motives, to make sure we're worshiping God the right way and with the right heart. Again, they're doing it wrong. They're hypocrites. Secondly, Jesus accuses them of preferring the rules that they themselves have created to the ways of God. They prefer their own rules to the ways that God has revealed for them already. And this is super important. All of us are going to be tempted to do this. It's much easier to create rules or to see what other people are doing in their Christianity, in their churches, in their lives, and say, I'm going to do that. It's a whole lot harder to read the Bible, see how God is, see who God is, and then live that out. Sometimes the rules are more tangible. It's easier to put your hands on them. It's easier to walk through them. You know for a fact whether you're accomplishing them or not. I'm winning, I'm losing. I'm passing, I'm failing. Okay? It's easier to do that with man-made rules. All of us are going to gravitate toward this in one way or another. All of us are going to be tempted to move towards religious rules that were created by human beings. These things look good, they sound good, they seem right. These are rules that are added on top of what God said or reinterpreted, reinterpreting what God says. Listen to what Colossians chapter 2 says. Okay, there's some allure to these things. There's sort of a desire to go this way. It's enticing. Colossians 2, this is verse 23. It says, "These have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-made religion and asceticism and severity to the body, but they are of no value in stopping the indulgence of the flesh." He's talking about observing certain days of the week, seasons of the year, worshiping angels, worshiping planets and stars. He's saying these things have an appearance of wisdom because of the man-made element of them, but they do you no good. He's saying they won't help you overcome temptation. They won't help you stop sinning. They won't help you worship God, but yet they will trick you into thinking that they will. They'll deceive you into thinking that they will. Okay, these things don't honor God. We don't honor God by adding extra rules to Christianity. Okay, we only honor him by knowing who he is, taking him for exactly who he says he is, and doing exactly what he says he wants us to do. We honor God by believing what the Bible says about him and acting on it. This is why it's important we read the Bible. This is why it's so exciting that many of you are starting to read the Bible. You now know or are getting a sense of who God is. You're now getting to know what he says, what he does, how he does it. It's an awful lot easier to go to church and just mimic what the other people are doing. Or it's an awful lot easier to watch movies and TV shows, read the media, look at social media on what Christians are supposed to look like and say, okay, I guess I can fit into that genre. It's an awful lot harder to have a personal relationship with God, informed by who he is and doing the things that he wants you to do. And all I would say in it is this: don't overcomplicate it. Trust what God has said and live that to the fullest. If you feel like you need to add more rules, if what God says and who he is isn't enough for you, okay, I don't think you're trusting God. He's not enough for you if you need to add more rules. You understand what I'm saying? If you need to add more things, it's not scratching the itch that you have. You might be a religious person. You might be a little bit legalistic. And you might not be in relationship with the real God. If you need the rules, chances are good that you're not in an actual relationship. And that's where these Pharisees were. They needed the rules. Okay, it was easier for them. It was better for them. They preferred it to following God in a relationship. Okay, real quick, I want to touch on this idea of tradition, because that's what Jesus says they're doing. They're following the traditions of man. Okay, so let's talk about traditions for a second. Question is, in and of themselves, are traditions good, or are they bad, or could it go either way? It could go either way. They're not bad. Did I give you enough time to think about that? Okay. They're not bad in and of themselves. Churches have all sorts of traditions, don't they? Think about any church you've ever been to. They've got ways that they do things. They've got rhythms and patterns and schedules and calendars. And, you know, they go on the same retreat every year, and they go to the missions in the same places every year. The songs they sing, the way they do church services, the camping trips, the retreats, the way that they talk even. You know, you start to talk like the people you hang out with. And so it's like we have our own set language at Believer's Church. You know, there's sayings and phrases that we use, and everybody knows what they mean. And yet if you go to a different church, they're using different phrases. And it's just English. I'm not saying it's like some made-up word. I'm just saying traditions are all the stories that were told and the personalities that say the words. And it's like, yeah, I know exactly what they mean, you know? In and of themselves, traditions are not bad. One tradition we have at Believer's Church, every year we do a camp out at the end of August. Menominee Church goes up to our campground in Connersville, the Duluth our church plants, comes down from Duluth, camps with us. Our friends over in River Falls that are doing street level and campus church over there, they come back. We all get together for a long weekend, and we just hang out. We cook food over the fire. We play volleyball. Volleyball is becoming a tradition now, I guess. This is one giant tradition that we have. We've done it for as long as I've been around, so 12, 13, 14 years. On that weekend, we do our baptisms. Anybody that wants to be baptized that's been coming around to church, you can get baptized that weekend. We do our church service out there on the Sunday. People that are getting baptized will stand up in front of 100, 150 people and share their testimony. This is how I came to know God. This is what God has done in my life. It's super awesome. If you've never experienced that before, you want to see some grown men crying, come to a baptism church service where people are sharing their testimonies. It's exciting. It's touching. Here's why we do it. Okay? This helps us to worship God. This reminds us of what God's done. This enables and enhances us to continue onward in the mission that we have. It's not a dead tradition. It's not some cold thing that we just do because, okay, it's August. I guess we didn't know what else to do in August. We do it because it's awesome, because God's awesome, and because it helps us to continue on with the mission he's called us to. Okay? And so traditions, these types of things, they can be good servants to us as we try and follow Jesus. They can help serve the purpose of how we do it, help us continue on in doing it. It really famously, it's been said, traditions make good servants and they make terrible masters. They make really good servants. They help you to continue on with what you're doing. Tradition, rhythm, you know, repetition, schedule. And they make terrible masters. When those traditions become lord over you, when your entire life and your decisions and the way you make those decisions is dictated as to whether it fits into the traditions, the rigid, cold, harsh traditions, then it's become a master over you. And that's not a good thing. That's a surefire way for a church to die, when the tradition becomes cold and dead. And this is the point Jesus is making to these guys. Okay, traditions become bad when the tradition itself, it rises up in importance and it supersedes God. It supersedes his commands. This becomes the thing that you focus on instead of focusing on God and his word. Okay, this is what he's saying about these Pharisees. Okay, these traditions, they follow the traditions of man, not the ways of God. I guess a couple of quick examples of how it happens in church in America. You know, some churches believe that the King James Version of the Bible is the only legitimate version of the Bible. Has anybody ever heard this before? Okay, I won't tell you which denomination. I don't mean to rag on anybody. They say that the only good, accurate, the only readable, the only worthy translation of the Bible is the King James, the Middle English, you know, same stuff Shakespeare spoke. They say that all other Christians who are reading a different translation of the Bible are wrong. They're reading blasphemy. They're reading heresy. They take this very, very serious, by the way. There's a church that believes that in this town, but broadly across America for sure. This is totally wacky. Jesus spoke Greek and Aramaic. He didn't speak, you know, Shakespeare English. The Bible has been translated into hundreds of languages so that we can understand it. The Bible is not, I mean, English was one of the later translations of the Bible. It's probably one of the most prominent, but certainly it wasn't one of the first. New Testament was written in Greek to start, translated into Latin, and on from there. But this belief, this tradition of theirs, maybe it started with a good heart. Maybe they thought, seriously, this is a good translation. I want my friends to read this because it's accurate, which it is. But sooner or later, over time, it became more important than actually just knowing God. I don't want to speak for people in those churches and that belief, but it certainly seems to rise above just the basics. How about you read a Bible that you understand the words and you can understand what it's saying about who God is and what he wants from you? How about you do that? Don't go into the jail. Don't go into different places where a very complicated and outdated version of English is harder to understand. I don't really understand it, to be honest. I mean, I have a dictionary. I can look up the words, but I'm just saying it became more important than the mission, than the ministry, than the gospel even. Another one would be infant baptism. You guys knew I was going here, though. I think you all anticipated this one. Tons of major denominations in Christendom, they do infant baptism. Anglican, Catholic, Lutheran, Presbyterian, some Methodists. I think the Nazarenes might even do some of this. Infant baptism. Okay, this is not in the Bible. There's no instance in the Bible where a child is baptized. Not unto saving faith. Okay, baptism in the Bible is an adult making a decision to follow Jesus, and they want to publicly testify of that, so they go get baptized with their friends or in front of other people. Baptism doesn't save you. Infant baptism doesn't save you. And yet there's this whole, you know, probably over half of Christians around the world practice this in some form or another. It's crazy. Or Christian denomination, I should say. It's not only not a good thing, I think it's a bad thing. It gives a false sense of security for those that were baptized as children, doesn't it? Or at least has the potential to. I got baptized as a child, I must be okay. I bet you I'm good to go. Okay, but again, salvation is not I go through some external activity. I mean, baptism, you dunk in water, you could say you're washed in the water, is symbolic. It's not the spiritual thing that saves you. Jesus forgives your sins when you put your trust in him. You're saved when you walk up to Jesus and you say, I'm yours. Please forgive me. Please make me into a new person. Infants don't know that. They're not self-aware. They don't remember. I don't remember being baptized. I just don't. Okay. And nobody does. And so these are another example. The tradition of man becoming very, very important. It's a pillar of many of the church denominations. And yet it does nothing for them. It does nothing for the people that do this. I could go on. There's others. Lots of church traditions that rise up and fight against the actual words of God in the Bible. And the Pharisees were doing this exact sort of thing. They're adding extra rules. They're ignoring God's more obvious ways. You know, the obvious stuff that he said. Jesus gives them the example. And he just says one. If you look at verse 9, he says to them, you have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to establish your tradition. For Moses said, honor your father and your mother, and whoever reviles father or mother must surely die. But you say, if a man tells his father or mother, whatever you would have gained from me is Corban, that is, given to God, then you no longer permit him to do anything for his father or mother, thus making void the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down. And many such things you do. So he says this is one example. They do tons of stuff like this. Here's the short version of this. Well, first off, notice Jesus' tone of voice as he's talking to them. I didn't adequately read it, but in verse 9, there's an exclamation point at the end of that sentence. He's ticked off. He's offended by them doing this. This is why Jesus continuously mixes it up with these guys. God is offended at our attempts to do this sort of thing. Okay, the Pharisees have rejected God's way, and they picked a way they thought was better. They invented a way they thought was better. And here's what that looked like. Back then, there was no Medicare, there was no Social Security, there were no retirement group places to live where you could have the Gales of the world take care of you. You took care of your parents after they were beyond working age. You had to. That was their, they had children, and then you took care of them at the end. Now we live in America, we live in Western society, it's a little different now. But honor your father and mother meant you had a responsibility to take care of your parents when they needed you, okay? Because they did. The Pharisees, this is how this works, this is their logic. They said, okay, mom and dad, I know you don't have money for food, I know you don't have the capacity to work to gain money, to have food, I know that you're needing a place to live or somebody to maintain the house. But I'm sorry, I've dedicated my bank account and I've dedicated my house and I've actually dedicated all my furniture to God. It's Corban. I've dedicated all to the Lord. When I die, it's all going to go to the Lord. So you can't really use it. You can't really stay over or live with, because all of it's for God. Okay, I don't want to ruin it. That was their logic. It's weird, isn't it? I can't serve you. I can't love you because it's all going to God. Now, meanwhile, they just lived in their luxury. They lived in their comfort the rest of their lives. They lost nothing from this. They said, wow, look how holy I am. I dedicated all of my inheritance to the Lord. Yet they lived it up, neglecting other people's needs, including their own parents. This is where Jesus is saying, you're negating God's law of honor your father and mother by making these vows and these promises and these extra rules. It's all for God. Doesn't it sound great? Okay. So that's what Jesus is saying. He corrects them on it. They're not righteous. They're in rebellion. The danger here is that we would ever think we can make some great, meaningful, you know, memorable, impressive attempt to love God and honor him that's any different than what he's already asked of us. Like we need to be creative about it, or we need to invent something memorable, something awesome. And that's what they're doing. They're saying, look how good we are, us Pharisees. That doesn't honor God. God wants you to simply obey what he tells you. I know that might seem like not enough. I know it might seem a little disappointing, but try it. I dare you. See if obeying the things God has said doesn't bring you peace, doesn't bring you joy, doesn't end up making you into somebody that is a lot more, I don't know, happy. Certainly it'll make you more holy. The goal is holy, by the way. It's not happy. The goal is holy. And we're talking about the idea of defilement. Part of what gets us down, part of what slows us from progressing with God is we allow ourselves to become defiled. We allow ourselves to become unholy. If you do what God says, if you do it in the way he says it, you won't have a problem with that. If you simplify your life, there's a passage in the Bible that talks about the simplicity of following Jesus, or the simplicity that is in Christ. A lot of us complicate this too much. We make these rules, or we see somebody else's rules, and we say, yeah, I want that too. And so we latch on to them, and we try and follow them. Okay, Jesus is saying, don't do that. He's saying these Pharisees, they did many things like that. Okay, and he rebukes them for every single one of them. Okay, let's move forward. We got very little time. Verse 14, he called the people to him again and said to them. Now, this is a separate instance. He's moved on. He's going to talk to his disciples here. Hear me, all of you, and understand. There's nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him. But the things that come out of a person are what defile him. And when he had entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked about the parable. And he said to them, then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from the outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart, but his stomach, and then is expelled? And thus he declared all foods clean. And he said, what comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and they defile a person. All right, so this is a separate conversation, but it's the same topic. I think the disciples may have asked about the Pharisees. They may have asked about this idea of being defiled. So Jesus explains it to him. And he says, it's not the external things you touch. You could also say it's not the external things you do. It's not your actions. It's what's inside. What defiles you is what's already in there. You do all those things that you would see as immoral or bad or sinful. You do those things because of what's in your heart, what's already in there. All of us are afflicted by this same malady, by the way. God created Adam and Eve in the garden. They decided to rebel against God. Sin entered the picture. We've all been born into sin ever since then. We're all affected by this within our hearts. There's evil and unbelief and all sorts of sin in there. And he lists all these things in verse 21 and 22. Evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, and on. It's not to say we only do evil. But when we do those things, that's coming from our heart. It's not as if we accidentally touch the cabinet over there, and apparently the rules say don't touch the cabinet, and so it's like, oh, I guess I'm a sinner now, okay? That's not how it works. I touched the cabinet because I heard I wasn't supposed to, and I needed to know what was going to happen if I touched the cabinet. Another way to say this, we're not sinners because we sin. We sin because we're sinners. Understand? We're not classified as sinners because of the sins that we do, as if it's an after-the-fact thing. It's like, I stopped eating meat, so I guess I'm a vegetarian. Okay, that'd be an after-the-fact thing. We're not sinners because of the sins we do. We sin, we do those things, because we're already a sinner. This is all of us. Everybody in this room, including me. Now, this teaching, this for me was a hard thing to get past. This is a paradigm shift. It's not as if the external things are wrong, I fix them, and God now will accept me. That's not how it works, but that's what I thought. It's that my heart is wrong. I need to approach God and get a new heart, get a new attitude, get a new mind, and then my behavior will start to change after that. When I first tried to become a Christian 12 years ago, I thought I could clean up my act. I thought if I become good enough for God, he'll accept me. Okay, I just thought that's how it worked, and I could not wrap my mind around this. He's explaining this to the disciples, and it says they didn't understand. I'm like, thank you. I also did not understand. I couldn't tell you what changed it for me. I just talked to a lot of people, prayed a lot. A friend gave me a book that I read that something clicked after a while. God is patient with you in this. If you're in the middle of trying to figure this out, God is patient with you, and he wants you to understand. It's not that Jesus didn't want his disciples to understand. Notice all the times he patiently explains these things to them. Okay, so he does. He wants you to understand, and he will explain it to you. But this is a huge hurdle for me, personally, to admit that I was a sinner, to admit that I needed forgiveness from my sin, and to realize that Jesus wants to forgive me, that he will forgive me. And this is the way to become a Christian. This is the only way to become a Christian. The Pharisees had it wrong. They said, okay, if I do Christian things, if I do extra things that are even more Christian than the Christian things, then I'm a Christian. That's not how it works. You're a Christian if you trust Jesus, if you follow him, and if you've been born again into his family. This is a spiritual rebirth. Okay, this is why the Bible talks about being born again, a new heart, a new spirit, a new mind gets placed in you. I didn't get it, okay? I thought I could fix myself with self-effort. My question for you, do you get it? Do you understand this? It's a total shift of paradigm. This will affect the way you live, by the way. This will affect everything you do. When you become a Christian, the sin doesn't just go away. It's not like all of a sudden you're perfect. Okay? In fact, far from it. You start to realize more and more of the things that God doesn't like, that are sin in you. You start to identify them. It's like a light gets turned on in the basement. It's like, okay, I haven't been down there for a while. I kind of half knew what was down there in my mind. All of a sudden the light is turned on. It's like, ah! I forgot about that. Sin doesn't go away when you become a Christian. But now you're free to not choose it, and you have the power to overcome it. God's presence in your life now counteracts sin. Your choice to make, still your choice to make. But it's not an outside in, it's an inside out. God changes you from the inside out. And that's what Jesus is saying about this. Your heart is what defiles you. Those evil thoughts, those bad motives, those bad intentions, those rebellious things, that comes from your heart. And that's what defiles you. Now, closing this down real quick. We're not going to make it to the end of the chapter, but do you agree with Jesus that your heart is defiled? Have you lined yourself up to this idea? I wouldn't say I was opposed to it. I just didn't get it. Okay, I wasn't rejecting it for my own part in this. I just didn't understand. But do you agree with Jesus that your heart is defiled? Do you believe it? Okay, have you allowed Jesus to make your heart clean? Are you trying to make yourself clean by your own religious efforts? We get a picture of a person that approaches Jesus with pure faith here. This next story, we'll just read one more quick story. It's not even for her sake, it's for the benefit of her daughter. But she approaches Jesus in a way that I think is helpful to see the way people are approaching Jesus. In this particular instance, let's just take a quick look at her, at what she does, okay? Verse 24 says, "And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him, and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth. She begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter, and he said to her, let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. But she answered him, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. And he said to her, for this statement, you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter. And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone." So Jesus travels to a place outside of Israel. Remember, his ministry is preaching to God's people, the Jewish nation. He's in Israel for most of his ministry. Now he travels beyond the borders. He goes to Tyre and Sidon. A non-Jewish woman, a Gentile, approaches him, and she has a need. Her daughter is demon-possessed. She's coming to Jesus to see if he won't do something about it. Okay, so she asks Jesus to heal his daughter, or her daughter, and he speaks in this sort of parable back to her, or this sort of metaphor, and he says, let the children be fed first. Okay, it's not right to throw the children's bread to the dogs. And by this, he means his ministry first is to the children of Israel, to God's chosen people, the Israelites, the Jewish nation. And the language sounds offensive, doesn't it? He calls this woman a dog. It seems like it's insulting at best, harsh at worst. Here's the thing. He's not using the word for dog that would be derogatory. You know, when I was growing up, dog meant ugly. You know, he called somebody a dog. He's not using the word for a female dog. It begins with a B and ends with witch. Or itch. He's not calling her that. It's not even close, actually. He uses the word for a household pet. He actually uses the word for puppy, which this is amazing. He's actually saying, here's what he's saying. At the dinner table, the family members eat first. We don't give the table scraps to Ralphie the dog until everyone has finished eating. That's what he's saying. And the woman replies, but even so, Ralphie does get some scraps, though, doesn't he? This is her approach. This is amazing, isn't it? This is faith approaching Jesus saying, I know you can help me. I know you're good. I know you'll make me clean. And in this case, it's for her daughter, but he's pleased by her faith. He doesn't say it, but her faith is obvious. She knows she has a need. She knows what Jesus can do, and she knows he will help her. And this is the kind of faith that pleases God. So as we kind of wrap this up, we talked about hand washings, and we talked about defilements and clean versus unclean. The way to be made clean is putting your faith in Jesus. He'll forgive you of your sins. He'll remove the power that sin has over you, that defilement in your own heart. It'll still have its effect on you, but now you have the choice. You're now free to live for God, to do what's right, to be pleasing to him. Okay, and the way of doing that is this bold faith that says, I trust you, and I know you're good. Let's pray.